Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Wednesday, May 24, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan's short-term ceasefire began Tuesday with few incidents.
Based off my own assessment, I can confirm it is a quiet day comparing with any single day that we have been in during this conflict.
The United Nations estimates that more than 843,000 have been displaced by the fighting in Sudan. Campaigning for Sierra Leone's June 24 presidential and parliamentary elections officially began yesterday, Tuesday. Media workers in Guinea staged a one-day blackout to protest military restrictions on press freedom. Tomorrow, Thursday, May 25, is Africa Day. Today, we focus on foreign interference on the continent.
Colonization was the first interference. The post-independence also happened to coincide with the Cold War, and that led to the destabilization.
And a new report discusses the impact of China's expanded police engagement in Africa. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudan's short-term ceasefire took effect yesterday, Tuesday. It comes as humanitarian organizations like Doctors Without Borders continue to complain about harassment of their staff and looting and occupation of medical facilities. Mohamed Al-Tahishi is a former member of the Sudan Transitional Sovereign Council. He told me late Tuesday that so far the ceasefire has taken effect in Khartoum with few incidents, but he says a short-term ceasefire is not the answer for the conflict. Al-Tahishi says Sudanese look forward to a sustainable peace that can address the root causes of the conflict, including security sector reform and the start of a political process that will lead to a civilian government.
Based off my own assessment, I can confirm it is a quiet day comparing with any single day that we have been in during this conflict. Yes, still we haven't seen any official report as a mechanism of that ceasefire agreement. But I can say is 90% being quiet. However, there is some claims around Khartoum, and our plan carried out some strikes in very early day of today. Where I am living, it has been dominated by RSF. And I can see that they be moved from inside the residential areas to the main street. And I can see that they a checkpoint outside the residential area. And this was a great movement because allow many residents to move inside the street. So this is the first day of the ceasefire agreement. And I really, really can see the difference on the ground. I hope for the two parties can stick to this ceasefire.
The ceasefire is only temporary, but what do you think is the future of a sustainable peace process in Sudan?
I have to say this as well. Ceasefire agreement, short-term ceasefire agreement, isn't the answer of the current conflict. We are looking for a sustainable ceasefire agreement. That's also not going to be an answer for the whole problem. This problem needs to be fixed when we address the root causes. And that is two things. We got to agree on a security sector reform, and we got to start a political process where we can establish civilian government. This is the actual answer, and this is the right answer for the current situation. I think, on my assessment, there are concerns about SAF, the Sudanese army, not going to stick to the agreement. Because, simply, there is a major division among these organizations. Some Islamist leaders, those are hijacking these organizations and completely against any waiving agreement. So I think those people, we're going to force the organization to continue the conflict. And that's why I think today the air strike carried out a bombing in many, many areas. Hopefully, this is not going to be the case. And we're going to see the commitment from these two parties to implement the ceasefire agreement. But the major answer for the whole situation, in my idea, is when we sign a sustainable and ceasefire agreement and immediately trigger a political process where we can end up to establish a civilian transitional government.
Mohamed Al-Tahishi is a former member of the Sudan Transitional Sovereign Council and a senior peace fellow at Washington, D.C.-based Public International Law and Policy Group. The United Nations estimates that 6 weeks of fighting in Sudan has displaced more than 843,000 people. Those who have escaped the country and those still inside describe dire conditions, as aid groups say the number of internally displaced is likely to become much higher. Henry Wilkins reports from Kufuor, Chad.
Rachid Khamis Abdellah escaped from Sudan hours before VOA interviewed him. He says he had been hiding from fighting inside the Sudanese town of Tindelti, just across the border from Chad, when armed men belonging to an ethnic Arab militia group broke into his home. He says he was in the town and couldn't get away when men he described as terrorists broke into his house and took him away. He says they threatened to kill him and that they are everywhere in Tindelti. He says he was taken to a makeshift prison where he thought he would die, but an imam told the militia members to not kill him and instead release him across the border. Kalun Adam says she fled Tindelti weeks ago, as soon as the fighting started, but has not heard from her son since. She says the armed group had destroyed everything. Houses and schools were destroyed, and there was no electricity. People ran away. She searched for her son to no avail. Weeks later, he is still missing. Despite their horrific stories, Abdellah and Adam are among the lucky ones. They have escaped Sudan and the violence. Those still in the country face a less certain fate. The UN estimates that more than 843,000 have been internally displaced in Sudan, trying to escape fighting between warring sides that show little regard for civilian life. It expects the number of internally displaced people, or IDPs, to grow. Lenny Kinsley is with the World Food Programme in Sudan.
The population of Khartoum, which is where a lot of the fighting is happening, was estimated to be around 8 million people. That is the hotspot right now. And a lot of the people who are living in Khartoum are fleeing to neighboring states, such as Jazeera, White Nile, etc. And so that number is only expected to rise.
Humanitarian organizations say they've been struggling to get aid into Sudan to help IDPs, but some has begun to trickle in over the past 2 weeks. Aid groups and media lack access to Sudan, so the humanitarian situation for IDPs is unclear. VOA spoke with an IDP whose name we have withheld for her safety, who fled fighting in Khartoum for Port Sudan on the Red Sea coast. She says she had to leave her family behind in Khartoum.
This is the hardest decision I have ever had to make. Several reasons forced me to leave them, as my mom is sick and she can't to travel for a long distance. I witnessed beatings, lootings and shootings for the target civilians in their homes. And lately we started to hear cases of rape.
Victims and health workers have reported numerous cases of sexual violence against women still inside Sudan. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Kufuor, Chad.
Tomorrow, Thursday, May 25, is Africa Day. This year's commemoration coincides with the 60th anniversary of the founding of the Organization of African Unity, OAU, now the African Union, at the 10th Annual National Security Symposium held last week in Kigali, Rwanda. Participants discussed contemporary security challenges, the Africa perspective. African Union Commission Chairperson Moussa Faki Mahamat was quoted as saying that foreign interference is not only destabilizing Africa, but it also makes conflicts too complex to resolve easily. Professor Sipo Sipe is the former Deputy Vice Chancellor for Institutional Support at the University of Zululand. He tells me that foreign interference in Africa began with colonialism.
Colonization was the first interference. The post-independence also happened to coincide with the Cold War. And that Cold War in Africa, it meant the Soviet Union and the Western countries trying to influence Africa. And that led to the destabilization and continued battle internally within the countries. Then the second one is African leaders themselves failing to sustain the democratic promise, where some of them became corrupt and it led to internal strife. And then they use NGOs that are supported externally. So there's no conflict in Africa that did not get a financial support and military support from outside. And what we've also seen is that the African leaders themselves tend to be beholden to Western powers. So it is no surprise that they can easily be manipulated. And it's important for Africans to start looking at African solutions. And this is why the AU was formed. But the first port of call is to deal with silencing the guns in Africa.
Professor, let me ask, because I see that the African Union Commission Chairperson, Musa Faki Mahamat, mentioned during that discussion that there is also the weakness of intra-African solidarity.
Yeah, because African leaders, they try to outshine each other and they try to be the good boys of the West or the East. You see how the president of South Africa gets so happy when he's invited to the G7, and he sees himself as a point man in Africa for Africa without even a mandate from the African Union. So this is what leads to this absence of inter-Africa solidarity.
In the article written about the discussion, Rwanda's foreign minister, Vincent Biruta, was also a part of that discussion. He was quoted as saying that interference is an intervention in a situation without invitation. And it reminds me about the issue in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Both Rwanda and the DRC are accusing each other of interference.
What we need to understand is the source of the conflicts, that the Africans themselves must resolve those conflicts. But it's actually correct to say, when you say somebody's interfering, it means that person has not been invited. And the problem with some of the border conflicts are religious and ethnic and economic. But they will need a form of mediation among Africans themselves.
Let me ask you then, what are the solutions to this whole idea of interference?
The establishment of AU is part of the solution. What they need to do is to start creating a rapid force deployment committee that will deal with the mediation, and where there'll be a selection of former heads of states who understand statecraft to be able to resolve those challenges.
Professor Sipo Osipe is a political analyst and a former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. You are speaking with us from Johannesburg. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 24. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. In Guinea-Conakry, the media on Tuesday declared a news boycott to protest what it describes as the government's intimidation of the press. Three radio stations last week said authorities tampered with their transmitters and jammed their frequencies. The Minister of Telecommunications has also threatened to shut down any media that he says may hinder social cohesion. Media workers, in turn, say the minister is an enemy of the press. Reporter Karim Kamara has more on the story from Conakry.
All radio and television stations across Guinea remained closed on Tuesday. Journalists accused the Minister of Telecommunications, Usman Gawal Jallo, of muzzling and intimidating the press. They say he ordered the dismantling of the transmitters of one of the private radios in the capital, Sabari FM. Two other radios say authorities jammed their frequencies and access to popular websites, provoking anger from the independent press. The telecommunications minister, Usman Gawal Jallo, has denied any crackdown against Africvision Group or blocking the internet and social media platforms. After the news blackout on Tuesday, the country's media associations announced more action against the government. Sekou Jamal Pendesa is the Secretary General of the Guinean Press Professionals Union. The President's spokesman and Minister of Telecommunications, Ousmane Gawal Diallo, has been declared the enemy of the press. He says as from now on, they will boycott all government activities, including all organs of the transition, until all restrictions on the press are lifted. He says the press will hold a peaceful march on June 1st throughout the country. The press associations have also written to embassies and right organizations to denounce the policies of the Minister of Telecommunications and the government. Media groups are further threatening to withdraw their members from two national institutions, the National Transitional Council and the High Authority of Communications, if nothing is done to guarantee press freedom and to restore within the next few days the transmitters of Sabari FM. Sabari FM is a private radio owned by Sanu Kadifalasise, and he explains what happened after the transmitters were uprooted by agent of the government. He says when the incident happened, he called the Minister of Telecommunications more than 10 times without any answer. He said he sent him SMS messages and he replied by saying he will investigate and confirm the incident. He says up till now, the minister never finished verifying. Reactions on the streets of Conakry on the news blackout on Tuesday included outcries of pain and concern. Fatoumata Camara condemns intimidation of the press. She says the public has been deprived from their right to listen to music and news on radio for no just cause. She says it is a bad sign for the country and that the government is deliberately mistreating its citizens. Internet connections, especially WhatsApp and Facebook, have been impacted since the opposition announced a series of political demonstrations across the country. Critics say the government is allergic to criticism and continues to turn deaf ears to the public cry. For VOA Africa, I am Karim Kamara reporting from Conakry.
Campaigning for Sierra Leone's June 24 presidential and parliamentary elections officially began yesterday, Tuesday. President Julius Maada Bio is seeking re-election as candidate of the ruling Sierra Leone People's Party, the SLPP. He's being challenged by 12 other candidates, among them Samora Camara of the main opposition All People's Congress, the APC party. Reporter Kelvin Lewis is in the Sierra Leone capital, Freetown.
Campaigning started all around the country for all the 14 political parties who are taking part in the elections, although only 14 of them have presidential candidates. But the ruling party used the occasion to launch their manifesto, and they are the only party that have launched their manifesto. We're still waiting for the main opposition, All People's Congress Party, to also launch their own manifesto so that we can see what they have in store for the people.
So did the opposition APC candidate also launch his campaign?
Yes, they started campaigning. They are supposed to start campaigning in the hometown of the ruling president in Bonds. These were given to the different parties. They balloted for which day they would campaign in which area. The Electoral Commission had shared all the dates for the campaign to them so that they avoid any clashes.
President Maada Bio is seeking re-election, and you just mentioned that he unveiled his platform. What are some of the key points he made in his platform this time?
He highlighted 5 points. One was and this is what he said during the nomination, that he would focus on agriculture. He wants to feed the nation. Feed Sierra Leone is what he called it. And in that, he said he would boost staple food production and also minimize food imports so that they will grow imports and also grow exports and create jobs. He also spoke about human capital development. And interestingly, he spoke about the youth employment scheme, in which he said that he is promising under a presidential initiative to create 500,000 jobs for youth in 5 years. That is about 100,000 jobs every year.
Tell us, Kelvin, the opposition APC candidate, Mr. Samura, he had been facing some legal challenges or legal problems. What is the latest now?
Well, he has two issues. The first one, which he has been facing for the past 3 years, I think, that one was postponed till the next sitting would happen sometime next month after the elections. But he has a new challenge. Two of his members are challenging his candidacy in the Supreme Court. So we're waiting for the Supreme Court, for the Chief Justice to empanel judges so that the case can be heard. And the Supreme Court has 30 days legally in which they should hear that.
That was reporter Kelvin Lewis speaking with us from the Sierra Leone capital, Freetown. A new in-depth report released on Tuesday says China's expanded police engagements in Africa could have potentially far-reaching consequences for security on the continent. More than two-thirds of African nations have strategic agreements or extradition treaties, or both, with China, according to Africa analyst Paul Natulia, who authored the report for the African Center for Strategic Studies. Natulia tells viewers Carol Van Dam that the wholesale application of the Chinese style of policing is problematic, given the resurgence of dominant one-party states and authoritarian practices in Africa.
There's very, very little research on it, very little visibility on it. These engagements, or these interactions, if you will, they outweigh Chinese military-to-military engagements. So the focus on Chinese security in Africa tends to focus on the military side. But on the public security and the policing and the law enforcement side, the engagement is much more intense. It's much more developed. It's been taking place over a longer period of time. The second implication is the diffusion of policing norms, models, governance norms, and political norms, if you will, are much more targeted and much more effective in this particular area, arguably, than in other areas. And why do I say that? I say that because policing is a very intimate area of security in any African country. Citizens are going to run into police. They're going to work with police on a day-to-day basis, right? You're going to, you know, it could be a traffic stop, it could be a burglary, it could be, you know, an arrest, it could be, you know, it's much more intimate. And so when you have this sort of engagement that is occurring with such frequency and such intensity, it allows for the diffusion of norms much more easily.
When you point that out, that makes me think it's become more political. Is that true?
It is political. It is political, but then it also provides for opportunities to shape the norms, right, that these police organizations operate by, because the structures are the same. The structures mirror. Now, African police organizations are not structured because African countries are sort of cutting and pasting the Chinese model. It just happens to be that these police organizations are very similar to how the police in China operate.
Are these kinds of policing practices having a chilling effect on journalists as well as opposition figures? Because you mentioned it kind of has that political linkage with the justice ministers being kind of on the top rather than how it works in the U.S., for example.
Yes, potentially, because, you know, police, the justice and law enforcement sectors are viewed as the most corrupt, but then at the same time, the most feared institutions on the African continent.
That was Paul Natulia, research specialist with the African Center for Strategic Studies. He was speaking with viewers Carol Van Dam in Washington. And that's it for this Wednesday, May 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a very good Wednesday.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including the latest on negotiations between President Joe Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy on raising the U.S. government's $31.4 trillion debt ceiling with days before a possible default. For this and more, join us for Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.